With great mojo comes great responsibility. Mojo 5-0. Mojo 5-0.
We will make America great again.
Sam Sorbo.
I'm your host, Sam Sorbo. Thanks so much for joining me. This week marks the two-year anniversary of the Janus decision, which affects public sector employees and their First Amendment rights. We're going to talk about that coming up. Also, what does winning look like? I have a special guest for you. This is a jam-packed show because I've got three guests coming on. Evangelicals today are deeply divided over Donald Trump. Some of them see him as a bit of a savior figure, anointed to make America great again, but others see him more like the Antichrist, doing great harm to the nation and bringing embarrassment to the church. We're going to talk to somebody who is in the evangelical movement about this. And before I get into all of that, I just want to let you guys know that, first of all, I will be doing a show tomorrow for Independence Day. That'll mark my last show going forward for a little while anyway. I'm taking a bit of a sabbatical. Thank you for all of your kind comments, the wonderful emails that I've been getting, and the comments on Twitter. I do appreciate it. And if you're not following me on Twitter, why the heck not? Also, let's see, there's been a major announcement in the media. I don't know if you've heard this, but white bread from now on will be known as privilege loaf instead. So mark your words so you don't misspeak when you're speaking of food, because everything is political these days. All right. Enough with that. Let's talk with my first guest. Vincent Vernuccio he's got over a decade of expertise in labor law and policy and is regarded as one of the leading experts in the field. And of course, we're talking about the Janus decision and sort of the developments that have stemmed off of that. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam, thanks for having me, and happy Janiversary.
Yeah, I love that. So this is important because we're talking about compelled speech. And so the Janus decision basically said, you cannot compel speech. In other words, your union has certain political stances that may or may not represent the people who would normally have to belong to the union, and therefore they can't necessarily collect dues from those union members without their express permission, correct?
That's right. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that everything that government unions do, so we're talking about public employees here, is political. So just think about it. If a government union is negotiating for salaries, where does that money come from? It's your tax dollars and mine. If they're negotiating for, let's say, a longer or shorter school day, what is that? That is public policy. So Mark Janus, who was an Illinois public employee, went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and said that, hey, you know, even just negotiating, all these government unions, everything they're doing is political. And the Supreme Court agreed and essentially brought right to work to the entire country for public employees. But they went further than that. And they said, not only do public employees have a right to be able to choose to pay that union or not, but that those unions and those employers, they need what Justice Alito called evidence of affirmative consent. So essentially, those public employees have to be informed of their rights, and then those employers need something signed directly from them saying, yeah, I know I have a right not to pay, but I choose to do it anyway.
So this is fascinating, and I'm no expert in this field, but I remember when there was a decision that you could actually, they sued the union, it was a teachers union, and I believe they sued them and said, you're misrepresenting me, why do I have to pay dues? And so there was a decision that you could opt out, but in order to opt out, you had to jump through a whole bunch of hoops to get your money back from the union because it was automatically deducted. But this turns that on its head. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
That's right. So before Janus, you could opt out of the union. And this is where they always get you. It's, oh, yeah, no one's forced to be a union member. But the catch was that you had to pay the vast majority of your dues in what is known as agency fees. So they say, yeah, you don't have to pay for union politics, but you still have to give us 80-90% of what the dues are. They call that agency fees. So that was what the standard was for public employees, and unfortunately still is the standard for private sector employees in non-right-to-work states. But there is another issue, and that's the windows issue. I think that's something else that you were getting at with that case, in that a lot of states, you're looking at California, New York, New Jersey, they can actually limit when public employees can exercise their rights. And I think that's a direct violation of the Janus case, and say, you know, you can only get out during a narrow window every year.
Right. It's like the gym membership. Oh, sure. No, you can quit any time. We just need you to come down here and we need you to sign this letter. And then you have to mail the letter in, and then you have to, you know, take a photo of whatever and have your driver. Like, they make it so onerous, and the unions were, and you had to do it every year. Like, you could, it wasn't like just, okay, once you're opted out, you're opted out. No, they made you jump through all these hoops every single year. And so it was as good as you really couldn't get out of paying all of your union dues.
Exactly. And that's why attorney generals in Alaska, Texas, Indiana, state legislatures like Florida, where they just passed a bill out of the House earlier this year, bills introduced in Kansas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, several other states are saying, you know, that's just not right. Janus said you have to have that evidence of affirmative consent. You have to have that opt-in. It's now a constitutional First Amendment right. And because of that, what you're actually doing as a public employee is waiving your First Amendment right not to pay. And those waivers, almost think like Miranda rights, those waivers can expire. So what all of these attorney generals and these state legislators are doing is saying that not only do you opt in, but public employees, they have a right to re-up every year. But it shouldn't be taken for granted. You shouldn't opt in once and that lasts for your entire career, which could be decades.
This is a big blow for you, for public, it's public sector unions, right?
We are talking about public sector unions, but it's protecting the First Amendment rights of public employees. If public sector unions are doing a good job, they'll get their members to re-up. But what we're talking about here is giving those members the choice and allowing them to periodically say, yeah, you know what, just like open enrollment, just like you re-up for insurance, saying, yeah, I still want to keep paying this union. I know I have a right not to. I've been informed that I have a right not to, but I'm going to do so anyway.
Right. It's amazing. It's amazing. What do you see for the future for this and moving even more forward? I mean, this is sort of like, in a sense, it was taxation without representation. And so the Supreme Court ruled, no, you need to have representation. You need to make sure that these people want to be represented that way. Going forward, what do you see?
You know, I see more and more attorney generals agreeing with General Paxton in Texas, General Clarkson in Alaska, other state legislators following Florida's lead, and Florida fully passing it. Same with Kansas, Louisiana, and other states where it's been introduced, more states introducing this. And I mean, eventually we might get a, well, we really mean it case from the Supreme Court saying, yeah, you know, you actually have to have that evidence from that public employee.
Right.
If you as an employer want to take dues from them, and you can't just simply take the union's word for it.
Right. Great. It's great news. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Is there a website you want to send people to, Vince?
Sure. Mackinac.org, MACKINAC. We spell things a little weird up there in Michigan. Mackinac.org. So all the information is there if you're interested.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
No, thank you so much for coming on. I suppose if you're in a public sector union, this is something that ought to be interesting to you. So that's good news. Okay. Let's see. I want to get through so much today. Did you hear that Alyssa Milano has come out with a new, I know, but it's important that we talk about this. She said Hollywood actors need to pledge never to take a role where they have to pretend to be someone else. No, seriously. She wants to push for inclusivity. She says actors across Hollywood should resign from their roles today and they should take a pledge never to take a role where they have to act like someone who they aren't. Actually, this is off the Babylon Bee, one of my very favorite news sites. I shouldn't call it a news site. It's parody. It's satire, but it's good stuff. Actors should not act like someone, they're quoting her here, but of course it's not really a quote. And they're very clear that this is parody. This is satire. She said, actors should not act like someone else since this is appropriating the culture, thoughts, acts, and attitudes of a different person. According to an Instagram video that doesn't exist, of course. I would also like to apologize for the times I have acted like I am someone that I am not, from the time I was pretending to be a witch, even though I am not really a witch, to the time... That's the only role I can remember. I'm sure I had a few more. I'm sorry for those too. There are only a few actors still left in major roles after this, with Larry David being allowed to continue playing himself in Curb Your Enthusiasm, among others. Marvel, in particular, has been hit hard, and the company is currently frantically searching for people who have actual superpowers or are real Norse gods to play their big roles. They did manage to find an actual raccoon to live and a live tree to play Rocket and Groot, respectively, wishing Bradley Cooper and Vin Diesel good luck in their future careers, should someone decide to make a movie about Bradley Cooper or Vin Diesel. Many actors lost starring roles in huge productions due to this movement, though Alyssa Milano still has the same number of big-name parts that she did before the movement started. Oh, they're so mean. Satire can be mean. It's pretty funny. Hashtag take the pledge. If you want to tweet that, I'll retweet it. It's pretty funny. Hashtag take the pledge. Do it. Do it now. France. This is off of Gatestone Institute. During France's lockdown, a law was passed to fine heavily any social network that published what a judge might consider hateful. People are also now asked to report to the Justice Department any suspicious statement they read or hear about. Since schools and high schools have reopened, teachers were invited by the government to listen to the conversations of their students and immediately to report any comment criticizing the government. Does this sound at all familiar? Like, I don't know, communism, Nazism, socialism, anybody? According to Ivan Rioufol, a columnist for Le Figaro, at the source of French misfortune, there are French traitors who bear French first names. They have been abusing the voters' trust for more than 40 years. They lied about the real state of society and ransacked the country. It's fascinating. Things are not all rosy over in post-pandemic France. In fact, they're calling it disastrous. Disastrous. So French police have been ordered to avoid going into no-go zones in France. On April 19th, a young man riding a motorcycle at high speed hit the door of a police car near a sensitive zone. Sensitive, they're calling them now. Sensitive zone. In a suburb of Paris, he was injured. For days throughout the country, buildings and cars were burned. This is what I don't understand. Well, no, I do understand it. I should. By the way, never say you don't understand something. Just say, I haven't fully worked it out yet. Because we do understand why people loot and pillage and burn things down. Do we not? The reason is because they can, because they found the perfect excuse. Otherwise, well, I don't have a good explanation. A Black Lives Matter founder admitted that he was guided by communism. They want to remove Trump, and they're trying to promote socialism, and they want to tear down the nuclear family. Now, I told you this yesterday also, but I think it bears repeating. So it's no surprise that Greater New York Black Lives Matter president Hawk Newsom is threatening to burn the system down if the movement doesn't get what it wants. He's quoted on the story with Martha McCallum, which is a Fox News program, as saying this: if this country doesn't give us what we want, then we will burn down the system and replace it, all right? And I could be speaking figuratively, I could be speaking literally. It's a matter of interpretation. Let's be very real and let's observe the history of the 1960s. When black people were rioting, we have their highest growth in wealth, in property ownership. Think about the last few weeks. Since you started protesting, there have been 8 cops fired across the country. So half of that might be true, but half of it's just an outright lie. When black people riot, their wealth doesn't go up. Everybody's wealth goes down. The whole community, as a community, goes down. So I guess I struggle because there are so many people out there with so-called facts that bear no resemblance to the truth. And this is the fight that we're up against. And then, you know, you get into a bit of a confrontation and somebody says, well, I don't know where you get your facts from. And you say, well, I get them off of the CDC website. And they say, well, I don't know about that. And that ends the conversation because they don't want to have the conversation. They want to know what they already know. They want to know what they already know, and they're unwilling to learn anything new. And why is that? Because that is the result of the way that our school systems have been run for decades. All right, with that, I want to bring in my next guest. He's a financial advisor with Northwestern Mutual. He's the president of Paintings for Pediatrics, and he also hosts the hashtag winning podcast. By the way, Paintings for Pediatrics is a benefit for childhood cancer, and his podcast talks about success stories for society to hear the real world paths of people who have taken the paths that people have taken to get their successes, not the socially imposed versions. And that's why he's a hero of mine, because he took the less traveled pathway. And this is what I'm urging people to do with homeschooling, because the paths that have been worn so well tend not necessarily to produce the results that they promise. Welcome to the program, Craig Sorbo.
Hey, Sam, how are you?
I'm really good. By the way, I really like your last name. Okay, full disclosure, we are distantly related. I've known Craig for a long time. And I've watched his tremendous success, and now he's launched this new podcast called Winning. And I urge you guys to tune in because, first of all, he's a great storyteller, and he has great guests on. In fact, I was one of your guests, so I know you have great guests on.
That's right. That's right.
All right. So talk to me about this idea of winning. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your story and then how you started this podcast?
Oh, I appreciate it. So, yeah, you know, as you know, but a lot of people don't, you know, until I was 18 years old, my path was probably very traditional. You know, good student, honor roll, everything else, I went with that. You know, college was certainly the idea. Didn't know what I wanted to do. Knew I liked cars in high school, but had no idea what I wanted to do. I don't think the personality test, you know, panned out well. They said, hey, you could be an engineer or a taxi driver. I said, wow, it sounds like a really good test, so I can do whatever I want, is what you're telling me. So I went to school for mechanical engineering, which for the people that know me now and the people that even knew me when I was 10,
what's
was
the
not
test?
The path, actually.
I'm sorry, I just have to break in. Like, what's the test that says you could be an engineer and, or, you know, a taxi driver? Because those two things are so closely related.
So
it seems so obvious that would, like,
that is literally the test that I took. That was my job test in high school.
So when
they do a personality evaluation, it was crazy.
Right. So you're like, okay, I've got a lot of confidence in that. Let me try the engineering thing, because that at least sounds sort of promising.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought
engineers make money, right? And all of us when we're 18, what do we want to do? We want to make money, right? It has nothing to do with the career or anything else associated with it. We want to find a career that can pay us, that we kind of like. You know, without any test driving of it, you know, typically get internships and, you know, junior, senior in high school or in college rather, but nothing really set up in high school. You know, you take that test and then there. So I ended up going to college. I was in a mechanical engineering degree. You know, somehow I was in a mechanical engineering degree, but they had us reading in a history, in an English class, which I don't know how those line up either, right? But in this English class, they had us read a socialist book, went through that. Teacher asked my opinion. I said, I don't want to give it, you know, because I thought different in college than most college kids. I was a conservative when I was 13 years old. Just seemed to make sense to me. I just said, let me get through this class. I don't want to answer any questions. And she
What was the book?
I would have to go back.
I don't remember. Okay, you just know that you disagreed with the
It was, I mean, it was a book. Everybody should be paid the same money. I looked at my classmates. I said, guys, we're in here paying all this money for school, and you're literally buying into this that we should all make the same money regardless of our path. That seems crazy to me, right?
Why are you bothering with school?
Right. Why would we be in school? Why are you paying money? How are you investing? You know, when the schools are telling you you're going to make more money by going to college, but yet the college is telling you that we should all be
compensated
the same. It's a walking contradiction. So the teacher told me that it was a liberal arts school. If I didn't like it, I should leave. So I did. I took her advice there. I appreciated that advice. I got up and I left school. And I did it with the mindset of, you know, competitive nature. So I'm an athlete by nature. I love competition. You know, so when you graduate high school, you look at your high school kids and, hey, at our 10-year reunion, who wins? And this idea of winning, not in a negative light, right? But winning, I think, has to have a positive connotation that it's okay to win. Right? Somebody has to be better than somebody else. That's how the people below get better. Right? You got to chase the Michael Jordans. Right? What does LeBron James want to do? He wants to be MJ. He wants to supersede MJ. Well, if MJ was the same as anybody else, nobody even cares who he is. So, so that was the idea. I said, in early on, I'm going to invest. I'm going to do right. I'm going to outwork my competition. And that's how I'm going to find success. More so than getting the scholarly education to find some career that maybe I want to do after I'm in all this debt. I said, let's just go out and let's outwork the competition, which is what I knew I had in my pocket is I had work ethic. And I knew regardless of what happened, I'm going to do more than my competition. Tell me what my competition is and how do I win?
Well, okay. My understanding is you had a friend who needed to buy a car. You went with him. You saw the salesman. You're like, geez, I could sell circles around that guy.
It was kind of funny. You know, my dad and I, as you know, but other people don't, my dad was a part-time professor at the time that I was in college. So obviously in our family, a lot of academics and the background. So I was having a fight with my dad after I had told him, Dad, I'm dropping out of college because of what just went on. And that did not go over well. I don't think my dad talked to me for a few months. My dad, at the end of it, he laughed at me. He goes, why don't you go sell cars? I said, Dad, I'm not going to go sell cars. And then, yeah, a friend of mine called me and just knew I had some good car intuition. He's like, hey, I got to go buy a car. You want to go with me just to check it out? I said, sure. We walk in there, we're looking at this car for them, and they're hosting interviews. And, you know, I'm like, this guy's a knucklehead. And then I sit there and just at the front desk, I'm talking to the guy that's conducting these interviews. Casually, he's like, dude, you should, you know, talk about this as a career. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, long story short, you know, like 4 days later, I'm selling cars. I'm like, all right, I just dropped out of school. I'm selling cars. Like the path that everybody's like, this dude is destined for failure. He is going to fall in the abyss.
The family issued a cumulative gasp. Very brave, well, frankly. But here's the thing. When your own professor says to you, you shouldn't be in school, you can take that two ways, right? You can say, oh, you know what? I think you're right. Or you can say, no, you're wrong, and I'm going to prove you wrong. But when the cards are stacked against you, you know, it seems like you just looked around. Okay. The story that I remember is you looked around at the people who were your competition in college and you're like, they're all good. And I don't know that I can really excel in comparison to them. And this isn't something that really interests me. Right.
Yeah. Well, it was that, right? I think be honest with yourself. So I did look around my classroom and I go, hey, can I outsmart these guys? Can I out academic them? And I was honest with myself and I said, I don't think so. I don't think I can study hard enough to beat some of these people because there's some really intelligent people in there. But what didn't they have is I didn't think they'd have the work ethic when it came to the real world. You know, and some of those soft skills that it takes to succeed in society versus just be able to read a book and go to a career and, you know, incorporate what you learned into real life. So that was my mindset. And the other side of it was just understanding the debts versus the investment side. If I can start investing at a young age and I can make money and just have an understanding of that, in my mind, that was going to be winning. I was going to be able to live a comfortable life.
Okay, run through that, because I know you have a whole sort of a theory about that. So run through that for the audience.
Well, so if you think of somebody that goes to college, right? You take a traditional path. Let's say you have $50,000 in student debt. Most Americans, that takes until you're 38 years old, right? You start paying your student loans back at 23, 15-year repayment. You have those debts paid back at 38. What did that cost you? That cost you your glory years of being able to invest, right? Compounding interest, rule of 72, all things that a lot of people think they know, maybe don't put it to paper. But
what's the rule of 72, dear?
So if you take your average interest that you earn on your money, you divide it by 72, you will double your money, that number. So if you get a 7% return, your money will double every 10. If you get a 10% return, it'll double every 7. Right. So think from, if you start at 20, you go to 27, and you're getting a 10% return. If you had 100 grand, it's now 200 grand. Well, from 27 to 34, that 200 grand be 400 grand. From 34 to 41, that 400 grand could be 800 grand. So somebody could have $800,000 in theory by the time most people are at zero paying off debt.
Gotcha. And so that was part of your motivating factor is why would I assume this much debt when I can make good money and be investing it instead? And so you went basically in, you know, you did a bit of college, but basically you went into a profession where you knew you could excel.
Yeah. Well, I that's one of the things. Did I know I could excel? I knew I could work hard, but what is that? You know, what does excelling mean? How do you win? The only thing I knew I could fall back on was my work ethic. That was it.
You could always go back to college. Like you could just take a year and then say, you know what, that didn't work. Let me try this different kind of college or something else. I think the point is, you know, when you're that young, you really ought to have an open mind. And what they're doing is in our schools is they're closing minds.
Correct. That is true.
They're saying you got to go to college prep and career readiness. And yes, you've done a lot of work with high schools. And what's your message?
Yeah, it's, you know, you have options, right? So that's going back to the idea of hashtag winning is out there now to help people. Look at what's going on socially right now is people are saying they don't have the same opportunities. That seems to be an underlying message, is we lack opportunity. Hashtag winning's out there. Here's all the opportunity. You want to hear the stories? Go on there. Hear the stories. Hear the real life stories of what people have done in order to accomplish what they have, right? People are saying, I don't know how to get there. Well, if that's a knowing problem, we can solve it. But we can't solve the doing problems of society. If you're not willing to go out and do it, you're not going to get it.
Yeah. What does a lack of opportunity actually mean? Because if we really drill down, let's define our terms. It's one of my favorite phrases, right? You got to define your terms. You can't get squirrely with the terms. So you're saying there's a lack of opportunity. Okay. Define opportunity, the chance. Okay. Have your chances been diminished? Well, I grew up in the inner city. And what chances have you not had? I haven't had the chance to be wealthy. Mm-mm, sorry, no, that doesn't count. Right?
Right.
But I mean, that's really what they're saying is lack of opportunity is lack of quote unquote privilege. And privilege is just a pretty word for green, you know, money. That's all that is.
Yeah. And when they say it in context, sometimes, you know, people that don't have the people, the have nots, are saying to the haves they don't have opportunity, or the haves had privilege. Well, that's not always true, right? And that's part of what hashtag winning is about. Not everybody's, you know, you look at your parents, you're like, all right, you were full grown with a briefcase and you're killing it in your career. Well, no, that's, you know, it goes back to the iceberg picture where people are looking at the top part of the iceberg. They're looking at all the successes, but they're not able to see all the failures, all the challenges, all the problems that people have faced to get to where they are. And those are where character's made.
That's right. So, you know, I grew up with, I was lower middle class, I suppose, maybe middle class, product of several divorces. My mother used to dumpster dive for food. We shopped at thrift stores. So I can't boast that I grew up with quote unquote privilege, except that there was always food on the table. Okay, so in that sense, that's tremendous privilege, and I recognize that. Right, my husband also lower middle class. You know, parents. I think they. A family of five, they shared one bathroom, and the fact is that he worked harder and certainly continues to do so than literally anyone I've ever met, to the point where he nearly died. So you can look at him now today and say, well, he's got a lot of privilege. It's not privilege. It's hard won success is what it is. And we're with all this chatter of privilege, what we're doing is we're saying that the hard work no longer counts.
That's true.
That if you put in a lot of hard work and you end up with some great things in your life, you stole them. That's really what they're saying.
All right. They were given to you. You just got them.
You got, and well, you stole them.
You know, funny, what's interesting in that story is I'm the same, right? So my parents got divorced when I was two. I lived with my mom primarily, 95% of the time. And we didn't have much. So I tell the story often, but, it was interesting getting to see both contexts. So with Kevin, I got to see some of the best parts of life, right? I got to see some of that quote unquote privilege, and I got to see some of the work that went behind it, where I remember going to visit you guys in Vegas. I'm 16 years old, and Kevin had set up to go hang out with Tiger Woods. So I'm literally in Goodwill clothing going to see Tiger Woods. But getting to see both sides and then asking questions, right? Asking Kevin questions when I was 16, asking, Kevin's brother, Al, these success stories, people that I deem to be successful, really diving into success. And I remember Kevin talking about real estate when I was 16. So it drove me to buy my first house when I was 20. So I just said, all right, what does it take, right? Sit down, talk to a mortgage broker and say, how do I buy a house when I'm 16? Well, that was 2005. So that house purchase didn't necessarily work out as anticipated, but setting those goals up was huge. And I wasn't necessarily getting that from my mom's side as hard as she worked, but I got tremendous work ethic from my mom's side. So just taking nuggets from everybody that you can run across, spend time with, listen to, I think that's so important, and truly absorb the nuggets and take it. I think the number one thing that I did that accounted to my success now is I listened. Most of us as kids, we don't listen to our elders, right? They're wiser. Listen. It's amazing. You're going to pick up great things. They have years of experience that you're trying to get. Get it in 2 minutes instead of 20 years.
Right. And you're taking that stuff and you're also putting it at risk. So you risked in order to buy that first house. And was it the phenomenal success that you dreamt it would be? No, but my gosh, what you learned from that and the stepping stones that that provided for you to be where you are now. So you took a risk. You went into a car dealership. You got a job. You gave it your best. You were successful. And pretty soon, after, however many years, you were manager of like three dealerships. Now you've changed careers and you're a financial advisor with Northwestern Mutual. So clearly for you, career is a fluid thing. And it's really amazing what you've been able to accomplish. Let's talk quickly because we got 3 minutes. President of Paintings for Pediatrics. Just tell me quickly about that.
I appreciate it. So, in my mind, the idea is, a mentor told me, to those much is given, much is expected. So Paintings for Pediatrics is a benefit. And I didn't know much about childhood cancer. I haven't been impacted personally by it. I've known some people casually that have dealt with it, but I didn't truly understand, the immense financial burden, mental burden, everything that comes with it. When your child gets diagnosed with cancer, you drop everything to do whatever you can for your kid. And there's nothing out there that can protect that, the finances of that family, as families have to leave jobs. Sometimes you're traveling all over the country to get the right treatment for your child, all that stuff that goes on. So Paintings for Pediatrics is a benefit where we have children and families that have had, that currently have, or that have lost children to cancer, get to express themselves in a painting, something that's meaningful to that child. And from that, we take it to a gala event. We auction off these paintings, and we have the story of the kid underneath it. So in my mind, what was really cool and how that could benefit me, right? Because it's like, let's be real. There's always things. How does it benefit me? Well, nothing financially, but I want, and I'm so excited that when I get to wake up, I get to see a painting from a child from last year's event, and I get to hear that story. I don't care what went on in my day. And, you know, right, there's a lot of successes people say, and they think everything's glory. Days aren't always glorious. There's challenges I have every single day, some days more than others.
Right.
But when I look at that, there is nothing but gratitude for everything I have. And I think that is one of the key takeaways that we have lost as society, is we have lost gratitude. We're not happy for what we want. We just want more.
Right.
And we just want to take it from somebody else.
I don't have opportunity. You know what? Be grateful for what you have. If you live in the United States, you're already ahead of most of the world.
Right. Gratitude is an incredible, incredible feeling.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's hard. So those paintings, that was the idea. So the people that come that get those paintings, you know, just being grateful for what they have every day. Like you said, when you grew up, right, didn't necessarily have a lot, but you have food every day.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people throughout the world that don't have that.
Exactly.
And we're over here. I mean, look at the opportunity we have just to whine about what we don't have.
Exactly. America. Where do we go? Is there a website for paintings for pediatrics?
There is. So it's paintings, plural, for pediatrics.com.
Okay. And then for hashtag winning?
Yeah, hashtag winning will be releasing next week.
Okay.
So it'll be available wherever you can find podcasts. Try and put it right next to your show, Sam. but some great stories, right? Your story's on there. Kevin's story's on there. You know, some people that you get to hear, you know, you want to be an actor. You want to be an electrician. You know, hear success stories of people at the top of their game and how they truly got there.
And also,
everybody's path is a little different.
That's right. And also just hear the pathways that aren't the norm, right? So we're all shoved into this cookie cutter, you know, one size fits all norm that our school system tells us. But there are lots of stories out there that don't fit the norm. And so, hey, thank you so much for coming on. Craig Sorbo.
Thanks, Sam.
What a guy. That's awesome. That's just great. And he brings up gratitude. He's a very clever, as yet young man, very clever. Gratitude is the number one ingredient for happiness. If you don't have gratitude, how will you ever find happiness? Now, you can sit and moan and whine about everything that's happening right now, but I urge you to find a moment to sit down and count your blessings. Take a moment and think about what you do have instead of what you don't. By the way, Public School Exit is a weekly online webinar that I will be part of starting next week, starting next Wednesday. It will be every Wednesday at 11 a.m. PST, 1 p.m. Central Time, or 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And it will be a panel of experts every week to answer your questions, to talk about school options, different curricula that's available. If you want help, advice, if you want to know more about the exciting educational opportunities that are as yet available for your children that are not public or government school, please join us. It's free. It's an online Zoom call on Wednesdays. I have it up on my Facebook page. If you go there, you can find it. You do need to register for the call. You can bring friends. You can tell everybody, please spread the word, because we do want to have people joining us, and we'd love to be able to answer your questions. And this is really, it's an incredible, actually, initiative that's put together from a friend of mine in California, actually. And I'm joining a number of other experts on the panels that she's putting together. And I'm extremely honored to be, to have been invited to participate. It's called Public School Exit. And so you can just go online and search it up and register for the call, and you'll get the Zoom link, and you'll be able to watch or hear, however you want to do it. It's actually very should be a very interesting hour or so, and I think they're going to go probably kind of as long as it needs to last. But it will be every Wednesday. But do tune in, because you'll likely learn something. All right, if you heard the phone ring, I don't know why I can't make my phone not misbehave. The sound's off, but clearly it's not. So it rings anyway. All right. My last guest is an author of 40 books, including his latest book, which is called Evangelicals at the Crossroads. Will we pass the Trump test? He's a PhD from New York University, and his name is Dr. Michael Brown. Welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's awesome to speak with you, and this book is pretty incredible. I have to tell you, I'm working on a documentary right now that's a pro-life documentary that is basically trying to engage the evangelical movement and the pro-life movement to understand that Trump is really the greatest boon that the pro-life movement has had in decades, since Roe v. Wade. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, there's no question about it, and evangelicals need to recognize it. But here's the challenge. You know, evangelicals have been known as the morality matters party, the character counts people, that during the Clinton days we were shouting, you know, you can't have a man like this as president, and morality and personal character matter to us. And then when it comes to Donald Trump, in a certain way, with his past and his behavior, he's the least Christian, least evangelical president we've had. And when we associate with him, it can tarnish our witness. On the flip side, he has done things no one else has ever done. The stand he's taken for pro-life, the stand he's taken for religious liberties, the fact that rather than having evangelicals vote him in and then cut them off afterwards, he's kept his door open. He's surrounded by evangelicals. So that's why I wrote Evangelicals at the Crossroads, to see if we could navigate this, if we could vote wisely without tarnishing our reputation in the process. And that's the thing we have to walk through. But in terms of what Trump's done, it's been amazing in so many ways. And then you wince at other times and think, oh, he's his worst enemy. And it's only going to intensify as we come into the 2020 elections.
You know what? I wonder if it's a matter of your vote. You know, the way people approach the vote. Okay, I'm not voting for the personality. I'm not falling in love with a personality when I vote. I vote for the ability. Okay, and when you put him up against Hillary. I'm sorry, there was just absolutely no contest. So, but I think people misunderstand, and they think that if they endorse somebody, that they're endorsing their entire personality. But it's a binary choice at the time that you're going into the polling booth. It's not a, okay, this is the, and in fact, anyway, what do you say to that?
Oh, yeah, you're 100% right. I have a chapter in the book, What If Hillary Had Won? And then another chapter, the bottom line.
So it's a horror story.
A vote. Yeah. And see, here's a lot of us voted for Trump primarily to vote against Hillary. And now with Mr. Biden, no disrespect to him, but it seems that if he was elected, he'd just be a pawn of the radical left. And what you see happening, the chaos, the anarchy in different cities in America, it's like, okay, that's where we're going, in socialism and Marxism and an open attack on conservative biblical values.
Right.
So
worse than that, I think that he's aligned with the CCP.
But listen, nothing would surprise me. He certainly, when you look at Biden's history with China, it's certainly been as a friend rather than an enemy. He's not upset China and gotten the ire of China as Donald Trump has.
Right.
But if you think about it, where we tend to mess up is this, and I try to chart the progress of this in the book. For many of us initially, Trump was our last candidate among the Republicans. The more he won, the more we realized something's going on here. And then it was Trump versus Hillary. For me, I was a Trump opposer. When it came to that, I thought, okay, I'm going to vote for him. And then...
Hold on. How long did you
promises.
Right? How long did you oppose? Oh, so you voted for Trump holding your nose.
But at that point I was more hopeful. My wife was holding her nose more than I was.
Okay.
I was more hopeful at that point because I thought something's going on here, and I even thought I don't think he's going to get in without a miracle from God. So he's gotten this far. Let's see
you
what
can
happens.
Say that
maybe
again.
Maybe there's a bigger picture, and it looks the same way now. It kind of repeat with the polls and all this. But what happened was, then Trump gets in. So I'm a reluctant supporter, concerned supporter. Then he gets in. Then he's keeping his promises. Then he's keeping his door open to evangelicals. Then he's standing with Israel. Then he's doing a lot of the things he promised he would do right out of the gate. And then he's fighting against radical left. He's exposing the craziness of the media. So he becomes a bit of a champion. And then next thing, we begin to defend him as if he's God's man, as if he's flawless. That's where I think we made a mistake, as opposed to what you're saying. Hey, it's a binary choice with an imperfect system, with imperfect candidates, and it's just a vote. So from my perspective as a man of faith, Jesus has my heart, my life, my soul. He's my savior. Trump is my president. One gets my soul and my life. The other gets my vote. If we can put this in context, then we can pass the Trump test as we go into 2020 and beyond.
So that's what you mean by the Trump test.
Yeah, in other words, for evangelicals right now, look, I have friends that when they share their faith, they're just talking to someone about spiritual issues come up. The first question is, did you vote for Trump? And if you're perceived as a Trump supporter, you're perceived as a bad person. We need to be able to articulate this.
What kind of litmus test are we doing? Since when do Christians have litmus tests?
Yeah, well, the media has done a great job. The media has done a great job of putting things together, demonizing Trump way beyond what he deserves. We're not denying his failings. They demonize him way beyond what he deserves. Then if you stand with him, here, Trump is a white supremacist. If you voted for him, you're a white supremacist. I mean, that's the new narrative. That's the common narrative. So we have to overcome a lot, and we can do it by just saying, hey, a vote is a vote. And here are the issues. Let's look at the platforms, the Democrat Party platform versus the Republican Party platform. Here's why we vote. Here's why we make our decisions. And then here, if you want to know about my faith, watch my life.
Right. I think that's really a great point. And for instance, if you look at the Democrat platform and every single Democrat candidate, with the exception of one idiot out there who says he's a Democrat who's pro-life, which I don't believe, frankly. That's like Nancy Pelosi saying she's a Catholic and being pro-choice. There's one issue, and that is the value of life. And what we are seeing in the streets today, what we're seeing in the rioting and the looting and the aggression and the violence, okay, and the lack of response from our leadership to the violence, is a devaluation of human life, which is one of the tenets of the Communist Party, okay? And so to me, there is only one litmus test. Which candidate will support life the strongest? Now, we've had many candidates who said that they would support life. I was absolutely gobsmacked when Laura Bush came out and said that she was pro-choice. And frankly, that told me so much about the Bush family that I didn't want to know or ever have to admit to. And so when we see what Trump has done in the White House, what he did for Jerusalem, it's been absolutely exceptional. And so I don't understand any evangelical out there saying, but I think Biden would be a better choice. Give me a reason why. Don't ask me why I'm voting for Trump. I'm asking you, why wouldn't I vote for Trump? Who is the better choice? It's like saying, oh, the America's a flawed nation. Really? Okay. Tell me what is a better nation worldwide. There isn't one.
Yeah, and the question is, with all of our evident flaws, why are people flocking to get in here as opposed to Americans flocking to leave here, to move to Russia or to move to China or to move to India or to
Venezuela?
Move to Europe?
Where are the ones who said that they were leaving? Why haven't they left yet? Because they know it's a lie.
If Trump is elected, they're going to leave and they're still here. Look, this is the land of opportunity. This remains an amazing country in the midst of our flaws, because it's a flawed world. That's reality. The chosen people, Israel, went into exile for sin. It's a flawed world. I'm not going to be ashamed to be an American on July 4th, but a lot of what's happening with the riots, so we separate concern about police brutality. We separate the truth that Black Lives do matter. We separate that from the spirit of a lot of the protests and riots. It is iconoclasm. It is straight out of Marxist textbooks. It is, and I don't believe personally that suddenly tens of millions of Americans have grown a deep social conscience and are really concerned about racism. This is just the flavor of the day. This is just the latest way to bash America. This is just the latest provocation of leftist media. And we need to recognize what's happening. If you think that the mob is not coming for you next, if you think that you can have conservative family values and the mob will not target you, if you think you can hold to your Christian values and the mob will not target you, think again. The mayor of Seattle just realized that it was going to be like a summer of love. And it had the atmosphere of
fair.
A block party.
Yes.
Right, a block party. Well, when the crowd, even peacefully, comes into her neighborhood on Sunday, and then more killings of young black lives, now the cops come back to restore law and order. So on a certain level, those are the alternatives. Is there going to be a culture where law and order are respected in a healthy way, or are you going to have social anarchy? And look, when Joseph Biden is being tested on do you or do you not support defunding of the police, that again is our alternative. Which way do we go? I'm not looking to Trump to be a savior figure. I'm not looking to him to change the moral climate of America. But when you talk about keeping promises, that's a matter of character too. So he's got his character flaws, but then his character strengths. Everybody since Clinton, Bush, Obama, they all said they're going to move the embassy to Jerusalem. That's our law. Nobody did it. Trump did it. Where's the world of people? Where's the Muslim world going crazy?
And in fact, it didn't happen. Right. Those were the warnings. Oh, my gosh. This is the end of the world. Look what he's doing to provoke them. And nothing. I mean, relatively nothing. Not nothing, but relative to what they said, to what they predicted. But I have a feeling that we're going to see the same thing with COVID.
Yeah, look, there's a chapter in my book, Evangelicals at the Crossroads, that asks the question, did God uniquely raise up Donald Trump? And what's interesting is, when there was first talk of this in certain Christian circles, people said, you know, there was a king named Cyrus in the Old Testament. He was an idol-worshipping king who didn't know the Lord. And God said, I'm raising him up, and he's going to restore Jerusalem, and he's going to bring the exiles back. A very unlikely person. People have misinterpreted that as if Christians are saying Trump is uniquely God's man, and you can't question him, you can't differ with him. No, not at all. But that's how a lot of people understand it. What we're saying is he's the most unlikely man.
Right. David was a man after God's own heart. He was an adulterer. He murdered one of his good friends. Like, come on. It's not that they get the hall pass and then everything is perfect. It's that they are the right man for the job. And the fact is that the fact that Trump himself is flawed is part of what makes him the right man for the job. And he does things that are wrong, but he does so much that is right that no one else would do. He was the only one on the stage who said, I will not pledge to support whatever candidate the Republican Party chooses, because he understood that the Republican Party itself is flawed. And so he refused to give just unknowingly a pledge to someone who he had no idea who they might be. And when he did that, I saw an individual, right? I saw somebody who wasn't part of the herd. And that's what we needed for this moment in time. Listen, I want to thank you, Dr. Michael Brown, so much for coming on the program. You can go to askdrbrown.org. Apparently, there are thousands of free resources there. The book's on Amazon.com. And the name of the book, again, is Evangelicals at the Crossroads. Will we pass the Trump test? Sounds like a fantastic read and also a great gift for the 4th of July or for anybody coming up to the election. Thank you so much for coming on.
Great to be with you, Sam.
All right. So before I let you go, I have to tell you about True Faith, because I got this. I found this review on Amazon and I thought it was really cool. How often have we heard these are the times that try our souls and test our faith? This is truly it. We've been locked down for months and told that we were going to die if we work. But, you know, you're going to be bankrupt and homeless if you don't. There's never been a more perfect time for this book. He's talking about True Faith. These two superstars bare their souls with naked and brutal honesty through their personal trials and tribulations, interwoven with entertaining stories of behind the scenes, making of their popular TV shows and movies. Certain chapters took my breath away. However, their faith got them through it all. Be forewarned, if you are an atheist with even the slightest curiosity, this book will not only entertain, but it might transform you. You will be entertained with vivid, great storytelling, but you are going to have to conclude that either these two have had the most amazing coincidences and synchronicities that defy any numerical scientific explanation, or you might just walk away not only entertained but changed forever. P.S. If you are antagonistic to any notion of God or faith, skip the reviews and forward and just start reading the first few chapters. I guarantee you will be blown away. But I repeat my warning to atheists, it will strongly challenge your agnostic beliefs. So that is a review that's up, giving my book 5 stars, True Faith, Embracing Adversity to Live in God's Light. And consider moving over to that since my podcast is shutting down temporarily. And take a look at the book. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now go. Have a great rest of your day.